Is big money corrupting American democracy? We'll talk with a guest who says yes, and we will welcome your questions and thoughts. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with the co-author of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And we wonder if you agree that big money is corrupting democracy. How so? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. How are special interest groups, how are big money donors influencing government officials and therefore our way of life? Our guest is Wendell Potter, senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity, co-author of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
In the preface of your book, you say that the book was the product of a common sense of love and heartbreak. What do you mean? What is the love and heartbreak that led you to write this?
Well, the love is the love that my co-author Nick Penman and I have for our country. We're patriots. We both are examples of two people who have lived the American dream in many ways. The heartbreak comes in to what is happening to our democracy and our ability to self-govern. In the past few years, we've seen an enormous influx of big money to influence elections and public policy at all levels of government, to the point that our democracy truly is threatened. And the subtitle of the book, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy, is a very important part of the title, because the money absolutely is corrupting our democracy to the point that we may already be governed as an oligarchy.
Well, how is it corrupting our democracy? Donors give money because a candidate believes in what they believe. What's the corruption?
The corruption really is in the receiving as much, if not more, than the giving. To back up a little bit, we don't advocate getting money entirely out of politics. That's not even a possibility. Political campaigns require funding. Lobbying has a purpose. The problem is the inordinate influence of a few very wealthy individuals, billionaires, very rich special interest, corporate interest in particular, but also large labor unions as well, have the ability to influence elections and public policy. One of the things we write about is what happens on Capitol Hill, particularly on the House side, the House of Representatives, in which members of Congress have to run every 2 years for re-election. Money has become such an important part of their lives that they are no longer spending nearly as much time in their offices or on the floor of the House attending to the people's business. They are spending hours every day going off-site to their party's offices to dial for dollars. And the people they are calling are not people like, regular folks like you and me. They're people who are exceedingly wealthy or have the ability to write a $2,700 check without worrying about it. And these are the people that have the most influence over our lawmakers.
Yeah. And it seems, like it wouldn't be, it's unseemly, but you hear Hillary Clinton saying, hey, I've accepted donations from, Wall Street bankers, but I'm not going to compromise my stances on issues. I'm not going to be doing their bidding just because they gave me a campaign donation.
How do we know that that's the case? One of the things that we write about in the book is just how completely the large special interests are able to get their way on Capitol Hill and in the White House. The pharmaceutical industry, for example, never loses a policy fight in Washington. The way the Affordable Care Act was written, the way the Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit was written for the Medicare program for Medicare beneficiaries, first and foremost, lawmakers and the White House realized that to get anything through Congress, they had to first and foremost make sure that the special interests, the pharmaceutical companies in particular, but also the health insurance companies and other special interests, that they were okay with the legislation, that the lawmakers had figured out a way to write it with the help of the lobbyists for those industries in a way that will benefit those special interests first. That's where their allegiance is first, is to make sure that happens. With the banking industry, the Dodd-Frank bill that was passed in 2010 as a result of the near collapse of our economy was largely written by big banks. It doesn't do nearly enough to clean up the mess of our financial system.
I understand, but I guess it comes down to the chicken and the egg theory, you know, which came first. Hillary Clinton or anybody else could say, you know, this is what I believe and this is how I'm going to vote. But someone's campaign dollars are not going to change that.
Well, I'll go back to the campaigns in 8 years ago when Barack Obama was running for president. He said in his campaign that he wanted to reform the healthcare system. And one of the things that he said was that we had to have a public option to keep insurance companies honest. So, in other words, he was saying that as the healthcare reform debate unfolded and we were moving toward writing the legislation, that he wanted to make sure that legislation included giving the American people the option of enrolling in a government-run health plan that would compete with private insurance companies. He also said repeatedly when he was a senator and during the campaign that he wanted to make sure that the Medicare program had the ability to negotiate with drug companies to bring the cost of drugs down for the government and for Medicare beneficiaries. He said that we should have the ability to buy drugs, re-import them from Canada, drugs that were made in the U.S. But were being sold in Canada at a much cheaper price, that we should have the ability to buy those U.S.-made drugs, re-import them back in the U.S. and save a few bucks. He said all of that, but during the actual writing of the legislation, he gave in on every single one of those. So that's what I'm talking about. Especially, despite what they might say, whether politicians might say that they believe, that they promise us, the reality is that when the legislation is actually being written, the special interests that have the enormous amounts of money to spend influencing elections and campaigns and public policy rule the day, and they rule Washington.
Yeah, you say democracy has become coin-operated. Another phrase you use is legalized corruption. Can you give us an idea of the scope of the problem in how much of the nation is on the take?
It's very pervasive, and it's we're talking about both parties here. Republicans and Democrats alike are on the take. And I will say this, I have no doubt that many, if not most, people who run for public office do so out of a sense of duty to the country and of a real hope to be able to serve the country and the constituents if they're elected. But what happens is once they are in office, they find that they have to be, that there's no avoiding being under the influence of money and politics for the most part. Particularly if you're in a district that is competitive, because you want to win re-election, you need money to finance your campaigns. The people who have most of the money are the large special interest or the rich billionaires, and it also works in the reverse, and as kind of an intimidation. That if you are if there's a bill before you that you are expected to vote on, and the special interest expects you to say vote against it, the pressure is for you to vote against it, and if you don't, those special interests will finance the campaigns of your opponent and help defeat you at the next election. It's very pervasive, and as we write in the book and show many, many examples, Democrats are just as susceptible to big money as Republicans, and we also write that Republicans as well as Democrats understand the problem and are just as committed to trying to address it in various ways as Democrats are.
1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you'd like to speak with Wendell Potter, who is the co-author of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Let's go to David in Johnson Creek first. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Our government has been on the take ever since George Washington. When George Washington got into office, he says, I will not take a salary, but pay my expenses. And that is far outweighed his salary. The other thing is, the reasons for Donald Trump's appeal, whether he's true or not, but when he pulls his airplane up to the gas pump, it's his impression. He puts his credit card in there to pay for that gas. When Ted Cruz pulls his airplane up, you got someone could be in Saudi Arabia that's paying for that gas. Now, he's got a... Now, anybody thinks that Democrats, Republicans, and I'm just a truck driver going across the United States of America here, I think the politicians in this country, they're like used car salesmen. They'll come up to you. They have this persona of, we know how to talk to you, but they don't. And I think Bernie Sanders, too. There's a real problem in this country that's bubbling up. And I think that the politicians, the standard way that they present themselves and everything, people are seeing through that. And with Hillary, I think she has way too much baggage. But they're looking at Donald Trump like, well, it's his time, and he doesn't seem to be on the take.
Well, that's right, isn't it, Wendell Potter, that's one of the reasons why people think Donald Trump is doing so well in the primaries, is that he is self-financed. He says that in his speeches. I'm not taking money from anybody.
He does, and I think David is exactly right. Polls show that large numbers of Americans, Republicans as well as Democrats, 80% or more of Americans sense this issue and are outraged by it, and they want something done about it. And I think that really goes a long way to explaining the appeal of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Bernie, of course, is not accepting large campaign contributions, and I think the average donation to his campaign is like $27, and he's raised a lot of money to finance his campaign. And Donald Trump obviously has said the same, has used in some sense the same language that Bernie Sanders has, that a huge problem that we have in Washington is that lawmakers are on the take, and it's something that we need to address. And I think that that does go a long way to explain the appeal of both of those candidates.
Yeah. In fact, we were listening to Bernie Sanders in his speeches post Super Tuesday. One of the sound bites was, we have to fix our corrupt campaign finance system. That's one of his top issues. Well, how do we fix our corrupt campaign finance issue?
Well, it can be done in many different ways. In the book, let me just step back and tell you how we structure the book and why we wrote the book as it is. We're writing it to help connect the dots for people, to show just how this problem affects us in our daily lives. We look at five different industries. We look at the big banks and mortgage lenders. We look at fossil fuel companies. We look at pharmaceutical companies. We look at big food and beverage companies and chemical companies. All of these industries have huge armies of lobbyists that work for them in Washington and the state capitals. They spend enormous amounts of money to influence elections, and we demonstrate how that money actually affects us, how we are disadvantaged because of all the ways that they're able to spend money to protect their interests, to protect the status quo, which people are sick and tired of. The first part of the book gives us kind of a history of how we got to where we are. And David was right. We've always had corruption, but there have been times in our history when we have self-corrected. Teddy Roosevelt in particular was probably the biggest champion of campaign finance reform that we've had. And so during his leadership, during his administration, we really did address a lot of the problems that had caused a lot of the inequality in our society. He brought an end to the so-called Gilded Age. The back part of the book is what we can do about it, and there a lot of cities actually and states are already addressing this. Five states have initiatives on the ballot this coming November to address campaign finance issues, and many of them are red states. We've got Arizona and Arkansas, I guess, South Dakota, Idaho, and they all have ballot, and Washington State have initiatives on the ballot to address this.
Wait, the initiative, is it overturn Citizens United?
No, Citizens United obviously is something that's frequently cited as a big problem, and it has brought attention to all the money that is now being spent on politics. It's not by any means the only problem, and that's why we need to have more than one solution. You know, states would not be able to overturn Citizens United. That is something that will have to be addressed either through a constitutional amendment or through a change in the makeup of the Supreme Court to look at cases that are similar to those that they ruled on in Citizens United that could kind of reverse some of the damage. I think that in many cases, as my co-author and I write, the justices were somewhat naive in what they thought they were doing when they ruled in Citizens United. They were not politicians, so they were naive in thinking that the money that would be unleashed would not be corrupting. It absolutely has been very corrupting. So there are many different things that need to be addressed. Some of the states, for example, some cities just recently have passed good government initiatives. In Seattle, in November, the voters approved an initiative that will set up a system in which money from city taxpayers, the voters agreed to this, there will be some citizen financing of local elections, which is a very forward step. The state of Maine, a purple state, also passed legislation to clean up campaign finance in certain ways. The city of Tallahassee, Florida, the Tea Party and liberals came together because they both were equally outraged at the corruption at the local level, and they came together to also push through legislation to clean up elections in that town.
We are talking with Wendell Potter. He is co-author of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about big money in politics and how that money influences our democracy and our public policy and what we can do about it. Our guest is Wendell Potter. He is co-author of Nation on the Take. We welcome your questions for him. We welcome your beliefs. Do you believe big money is corrupting our political system? Do you think that special interest groups are controlling our politicians and therefore our way of life? How do you see big money playing out in the public policy in your community? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have Brad in Jefferson with us now. Hi, Brad.
Good morning. Wendell, I've been a huge admirer for years, actually. I'm a volunteer with a group called United to Amend. With them and formerly Move to Amend, we've been working on getting support for a constitutional amendment for the state of Wisconsin to support it to get the U.S. amendment. So far, we've got about 61 communities that have passed resolutions and referenda for a total of about 42% of the population of Wisconsin. When people vote, 70 to 80% of people support this amendment, regardless of what party they're in. We're going to have this on the ballot again, April 5th. It says that only human beings, not corporations, unions, nonprofits, or similar associations, are endowed with constitutional rights, and that money is not speech. And therefore, limiting political contributions and spending is not equivalent to restricting political speech. And we'll have this voted on in Beloit, Broadhead, Platteville, Darlington, Lancaster, Belmont, Janesville, Monroe, New London, and Town of York. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And really, it's a real hopeful sign. of what's going on in Wisconsin and around the country. More than 600 initiatives like that are have been proposed and or passed. So there is an enormous recognition of the problem and efforts at the grassroots level to do something about it. This is something we have to be in for the long haul. And one thing to keep in mind, too, is that a lot of folks may not yet be engaged in the effort to do something about big money in politics, but they may have another interest that's dear to them. Maybe it's doing something about the healthcare system or climate change or the environment in some broad way. Almost everyone has something that is of keen interest to them that they're willing to devote time and resources to. The problem is we can't make progress on any front, in any issue, until we address big money in politics because of the money that is being spent to make sure that nothing changes because the status quo is very, very profitable to those who have the power.
Yeah. So we can all vote on these ballot questions in Wisconsin and other states and advise our leaders that we would like this change. But if the big money is telling them the status quo is good, how are we going to change things?
Well, there are a number of things that we outline in the book. The last two chapters are titled "It's Fixable" and "The Making of an All-American Movement," and we outline a variety of steps that we suggest and know that can work. That will go a long way to alleviating the problem. Like I said, we know we're not going to get money entirely out of politics, but we can reduce its influence and we can level the playing field so that those of us who are not millionaires or billionaires can have more say in what goes on in Washington and the state capitals and even at City Hall by doing things like we're seeing in some cities like Seattle and New York City and other places of having citizen-funded campaigns. And in Washington, legislation can be approved to limit, for example, the influence of lobbyists. In South Carolina, a very conservative state, that state passed legislation that prohibits lobbyists from giving contributions to candidates. That's huge. That's a very important measure, and that would be terrific. It would be an amazing thing if it could be passed at the federal level, and every other state should look at South Carolina's example there, because a lot of lobbyists actually don't like the fact that they're pretty much shaken down by politicians for campaign contributions. There's a very corrupting effect that happens when lobbyists are able to write big checks for political campaigns.
Yeah, in the introduction to the book, you write, take for instance how a single family, the Kochs, which own Koch Industries, has forged a small but very wealthy network of donors who have pledged to spend nearly $900 million influencing the outcome of the 2016 elections. That's $500 million more than the Republican National Committee spent in 2012. A lot of us in Wisconsin are certainly familiar with the Koch Industries. Talk some about why this is so significant.
Well, just think about it. Those are two individuals, Charles and David Koch, who have such incredible wealth. They have an interest in influencing public policy in a way that would benefit their business and to reinforce their political ideology. I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or a conservative or a liberal. Being able to spend that much money to impose your point of view on our political system and on our society, it's just not fair. What we're talking about here is just an element of fairness. You've got people who are enormously wealthy who have now inordinate influence on the direction of our country. How is that fair? How is someone who is a middle class person or a middle class family or someone who is trying to live the American dream, how are they going to get ahead when the deck is stacked against them. That's the problem here. When the very rich and the very powerful are able to call all the shots, they're doing it for their own benefit, not for the benefit of most of the country.
Well, can you give us an example of how our lives are different, how our quality of life is different, our day-to-day lives are different because the Koch brothers are spending a lot of money on elections?
Well, the Koch brothers or any special interest. Like I said, we look at five different industries. Certainly, energy and fossil fuels is a keen example or a big example of how money is spent and in ways that are keeping lawmakers from truly addressing climate change. Big money is being spent to influence the way our lawmakers think and act, a lot of our lawmakers want to keep that money flowing to their campaign, so they're willing to vote against measures that are really designed to protect the planet. The chemical industry, for example, has waged efforts over many years to make sure that most of the chemicals that are used in products that we use every day are not even tested. There are about 80,000 chemicals, for example, that are used routinely in products that are fairly common or that we come into contact with, but just a small fraction of those are ever tested. We write about a couple in Michigan who suddenly were sick all the time. They had severe headaches, and they couldn't figure out why suddenly they were, both of them, both the husband and wife were ill. They happened to watch a 60 Minutes segment about a company that was selling flooring that had excessive amounts of formaldehyde, and they had just installed new flooring in their house. So what was happening? I mean, they were getting sick because of what was literally under their feet. The product that they had been sold, that they had installed of the flooring, had such high levels of formaldehyde that their health was in danger, and they were literally sick.
Gary on Facebook says, to limit the extent that a person can express their political opinion is suppression of speech. The cause with the most money behind it will not necessarily get the most votes, especially with the internet and social media. Money cannot make a bad idea better, and people are not as dumb as the media thinks they are. What's your response to that?
Well, that is the argument of that we're looking to infringe someone's free speech. Not at all. Like I said, we're not proposing to take money out of the equation. Money is necessary, but we're trying to level the playing field so that local governments and state governments can take action to make sure that those of us who are not inordinately wealthy are represented as our founders hoped we would be and expected that we would be, that we're all created equal, but we all don't, you know, many of us are able to and are a lot wealthier. Many of us are born into wealth. Some of us are not. Why should someone who is born into a family of great fortune be able to call the shots on public policy that affects people who are not? So we're not saying that money is something that you can get rid of. No, of course not. But among the things that even conservatives are suggesting is that we have greater transparency. A lot of the money that's being donated is being donated to organizations that are not required to disclose who's making that money. A lot of conservatives, in particular, are saying this just doesn't make any sense. These people are trying to influence public policy and elections and hide their identity. And there are a lot of conservatives who write and talk a lot about the term that they use is crony capitalism, of the ability of certain industries that are doing quite well to preserve a status quo that enables them to continue to have an advantage, to the disadvantage of of other companies that would like to compete with them. So we're often saying that the effect of big money is inhibiting competition in our economy. Yes. Just as an example.
And Wendell Potter, we're talking a lot about national politics in terms of the nation on the take, but a lot of people would say, well, when I mentioned the Koch brothers are funding a lot of state legislatures and state races as well. A lot of people will point to Wisconsin as having a Republican-controlled legislature and governor, and all the big changes in our state policy has been because of the Koch brothers.
I think there's no doubt that's true. And my home state is Tennessee, and the Koch brothers have a significant influence in that state through one of their organizations, Americans for Prosperity. There are times that I'm on the same page as Americans for Prosperity. I think that some of the causes they support are the causes I support. The concern is that there are the amounts of money that they're able to, the Koch brothers and others are able to funnel into an organization like Americans for Prosperity gives that organization inordinate influence. In Tennessee, for example, Tennessee is one of the states that has not expanded the Medicaid program, and there is a lot of public support for that. The Republican governor of Tennessee wants to expand the Medicaid program because he understands how that would be to the benefit of a lot of Tennesseans and how it actually is a financial benefit to the state. It would be if the state could expand it. But the Americans for Prosperity are ideologically opposed to it. They spend a lot of money, and the way it works is they are they keep kind of a checklist of, and they tell lawmakers that if you vote for expansion of Medicaid, we will pour money into defeating you in your next election. That's how it works, and that's how it's corroding and corrupting our political system. A few individuals have that kind of power to funnel money through organizations that can be that intimidating and that can influence elections in that way. That's what we're talking about. That's not fair.
We are talking with Wendell Potter. He is co-author of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. We will welcome more of your questions for him in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a guest who says big money is corrupting our political system, our democracy, and we are talking about how and what we can do about it. Wondering what you think, what questions you have, what are your solutions? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Wendell Potter is our guest. And Dave on Facebook says, want to stop the corruption? Stop supporting candidates that take special interest money. We Americans whine and moan about this problem, and then we ensure that it is continued by voting for Democrats and Republicans who take bribes. So vote for Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, and problem solved, Wendell Potter.
Well, I think there's a good point there that a lot of organizations ask candidates to sign a pledge. That's something that's quite common in American politics. Some lawmakers do, or some candidates do, and some don't. But what is wrong with if someone really believes as I do, and I hope that we're seeing the beginning of a movement, we are, of people really engaged on this issue, I would love to see a lot of people demanding that the candidates who are running to represent them express their point of view on money in politics and sign a pledge to not take contributions from wealthy special interest. I think that's a legitimate request, and I hope that we see that developing around the country.
Next we go to Jim in Barron. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Joy. Thank you for taking my call, and good morning, Mr. Potter.
Good morning, Jim.
I think that we need to get deeper into this, and that is, what has government become? As Willie Sutton said, he robs banks because the money's there. We're in a situation now where we're promising everything to everybody at someone else's expense. And if we, as a country, are almost $20 trillion in debt, government has become this giant giveaway. And politicians are feeding into this. The Bernie Sanders is a typical example. So we need to get back to the root of why is government into promising economic rights to somebody when that's not what our Constitution was all about.
Yeah, and you make a very good point. We are seeing in Washington, I think in more than ever, corporate welfare as well. One of the things I've written about that was just published this week on the website healthinsurance.org is about how the health insurance industry, and I worked in the insurance industry for 20 years. My first book was Deadly Spin, and it was I wrote that to tell how the insurance industry really works and where the money comes from, how they spend that money, how they spend money to influence public opinion and public policy. It may surprise people that the largest largest health insurers in the country, the for-profits like United Health and Anthem and Aetna and Cigna and Humana, the majority of their revenues now is coming from the government. So we tend to think of these as private insurers that are providing coverage to those of us who work and get our coverage through the workplace or buy it individually. Most of their revenue now is coming from the government. They spend heavily lobbying to make sure that money spigot keeps flowing into their treasuries.
Yeah, and I know that you are very well known for your criticism of the insurance industry and how the insurance industry influenced the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
It just reminds me that President Obama is coming to Wisconsin this week, to Milwaukee specifically, to talk about the Affordable Care Act. Apparently, Milwaukee had a lot of people sign up, and he's going to give us kudos for that or something. I talk some about how do you see the Affordable Care Act's future?
I think the Affordable Care Act is going to stay as part of the law of the land. Part of the reason is because the special interests really like it. They help write it. Now, that said, it does, in my view, it does do good. And I was one who said, as Congress was voting on it finally, that it was better than not passing it, because it contains some important provisions to regulate the insurance industry in a more appropriate way, to keep them from engaging in practices that were solely for the benefit of shareholders and that excluded a lot of people from being able to even buy coverage in the first place, or people were priced out of coverage. So it does good. It has brought more people into coverage, but it has really been a huge benefit to the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry. In this article that I mentioned to you, I look back to see what has happened to the stock price of the insurance industry, insurance companies, since Barack Obama was elected president. And since he was elected president, the share price of Cigna and Humana, the two companies I work for, have increased more than 1,000%. And that compares to, that's almost 4 to 5 times as much as the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or the market in general. So it's been enormously beneficial, the Obama years, to the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry, which is those companies have some of the biggest profit margins of any industry. So that's what I was saying, and I say whenever I have an opportunity. Legislation that is that we're told is being intended to benefit us has to first and foremost benefit the special interests so that they can continue to make the profits or to enhance their profits.
Back to the phones we go. George in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, George.
Yeah, good morning. I think one of the problems that we have in addressing this whole question is that when people hear the term campaign finance reform, it's a snoozer. They fall asleep. Yeah. It's beyond their ability to think further ahead than, yeah, everybody takes money. It's always going to be that way. I think one of the things that we could do to maybe improve the conversation is to use a different term. And the one that I favor, it's not my own, but I like it a lot, is one that's called, what we need to move towards is voter-owned elections.
Mm. I like that. You are so right. Campaign finance reform is a snoozer, and some people think that, well, what you're talking about is infringing free speech. That's not at all what we're talking about. But you're right. It's either a snoozer or people misunderstand what the intention is of those who understand the problem and are trying to address it. It's a big problem. There is a movement that's starting, but I think you're exactly right. We need to frame it in ways that is more easily understood, and that people can see more clearly how it benefits them.
Yeah. Well, in a way, your book is also trying to take it out of the realm of campaign finance reform, eyes glaze over, but how this affects our day-to-day lives, the public policy that is created because of this means something to our pocketbooks or our environment or whatever else.
Exactly, and that's what I meant when I said we wrote this. The original intent was to connect the dots so that people can see that while our eyes might glaze over at the mention of campaign finance reform, when you take a look at the effect of money on politics, look at how it affects our daily lives. And the media has not done an adequate job of doing this. In fact, I say this as a former reporter. I think the media has done a very lousy job of explaining to the American public how our lives are affected by all the money that's been in politics. The media in Washington largely just covers the horse race, the he said, she said of any given debate, rather than the substance of a debate and how our lives are being affected.
Let's go to Reed in Clintonville now. Hello, Reed.
Yes, good morning. Say, I just wanted to clarify something. Donald Trump has consistently stated that he's self-funding his campaign, and for a gentleman that called earlier and spoke, and for the rest of the public, the American public, Donald Trump is not self-funding his campaign in the accurate sense. Donald Trump has loaned himself millions and millions of dollars. He has he has donated to his campaign $250,000. And he has actually accepted millions of dollars from outside sources. But the money that he has loaned to his campaign, though he claims that as self-funding, actually is paid back to him at the end of the campaign. And consequently, his finances are not diminished considerably.
Yeah,
but instead, he has...
I get it, Reed, but the point is that he's not going to do the bidding to any special interest except himself, I suppose, but that's the point.
Well, the point is that he's lying to people. It's at best a deception and at worst a lie, because he's telling people and people think, oh, he's so rich and he's self-funding and he owes nothing to anyone else. But he does owe to others because he has accepted outside monies, and he's deceiving people because he's telling people that he's self-funding, but he's loaned his campaign the money. He's not telling us that he has done that, but he has done it. And I thank you very much for this opportunity to clarify this, and I will listen off air here.
All right. Thanks, Reed. Any comment on that, Wendell Potter?
Well, I think he raises a good point. And I think the broader point with Donald Trump is, does he really represent my interest? And also, if he wins the nomination, he has benefited largely from what's referred to as earned media. He hasn't hasn't spent as much money as some of the other candidates have. That will change if he wins the nomination and he's in a general election. So it will be interesting to see if he maintains that posture as well, too, if he says the same things during the general election than he does in the primaries.
Boy, how about, is there anything that, that can or should be done about the amount of money that politicians are expected to, need to, I don't know if that's the right word, spend on their campaigns?
Really, absolutely, we need to address this. One of the things that we write about is what happens to a member of Congress these days. I covered Congress as a young reporter back in the 70s. I'm dating myself, but I covered Congress during the latter part of the Ford administration, the first part of the Carter administration, and it was a very different time. Members of Congress were more collegial. They worked closer together. They were not constantly campaign raising money for re-election. They had time to work on constituent services and to really come to understand the issues that were before them. That's not the case anymore. The Democratic National the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee a couple of years ago, one of their communications was leaked to the media. And it was a communication advising newly elected members of Congress how to spend their days. And and the directive is you will need to spend 2 to 3, if not 4 hours every day, dialing for dollars. Just think of that. That is money. That is time that we think that our elected officials who work for us, they're our employees, we pay them their salaries. But they're not attending to our business. They're calling rich potential donors when they should be working for us.
So what advice do you have to those who perhaps agree with you, are inspired by your message, but don't know how they can be effective in helping to bring it about?
One thing I would hope that people to do is a very simple thing. My co-author is Nick Penniman, and he has an organization called Issue One. Go to that website, and it's a place to get more information and to figure out how people can get involved. Aside from that, take a look at what is going on in your local communities. Are there efforts to pass a resolution or encourage lawmakers to sign a pledge? This is something that's very important to do, but the website issue1.org is a place to go to get more information, to figure out how you can join the movement and potentially lead the movement.
You know, Val in Viroqua emails, "I am 84 years old. The only thing left on my bucket list is to live to see someone elected for what they believe in, not for how much money he or she has."
Yay.
is that going to happen anytime soon, Wendell Potter?
I'm hopeful. That's why Nick and I wrote the book. We're optimists. We think it can happen. We've made these course corrections in our history in the past. So, yes, I absolutely think that we can do it.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Wendell Potter, senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity and co-author of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Thanks to Marika Saval for producing the program. Thanks to Nyasia Ellison for on-air production and to Christy Taylor for on-air direction. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, we are going to take a look at America's obsession with meat. Is it healthy or not? We'll investigate tomorrow. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.